scattered through the ruins of the Mediterranean culture are the monuments of ancient religious institutions which have come down to us under the general name, the mysteries. This term is universally accepted, and when not modified in some way, generally indicates the religious rites and ceremonies of the Hellenic states, which we now call Greece. Actually, we do not know a great deal about the structure of the esoteric cults of the Greco-Latin worlds. We have a number of books that have been written bearing upon the rituals and ceremonies of these rites. Perhaps the most interesting and informative being the writings of the English Platonist Thomas Taylor, who gathered together everything available in the rich storehouse of the British Museum Library. He worked in many cases from original Greek manuscripts, some of them of great antiquity. But even his restoration is largely conjectural. The very term mystery perhaps indicates the dimensions of our problem. That which is held mysteriously, that which was not communicated to the profane, that which was performed secretly, under oath and obligation, might very well remain obscure and defy the reports of history. One point we have that is somewhat encouraging and helpful. At the critical period of the early rise of Christianity, a great number of pagans were converted to the Christian faith. Among these were several brilliant persons of unusual attainment, and most certainly initiates of the pagan mysteries in their earlier lives. These men are almost in complete accord with whatever the mysteries of the Greeks were. They were not profane. These rituals were, as one of the early Christian converts declared, of the purest possible nature. There was nothing corrupt or decadent in them. They were solemn, sacred occasions, marked by solemnity of spirit, dignity, graciousness, beauty, and piety. We might assume that such would be the case, otherwise it is not possible that the greatest minds of the ancient world would have found in these rituals and ceremonies profound inspiration and would have had nothing ill to say against them. On the other hand, the great question that has burdened every interpreter and student of this subject has been, what was communicated? What was the substance of the initiation ritual? We have enough information to know that several different incidents were united in the preparation of these sacred rites. One of the principal elements of the initiation was obviously dramatic. Certain parts of the rituals were communicated in pageantry, in drama, and by means of a narrative performed by actors. These actors were in almost every case priests, and they portrayed the various sacred persons whose religions and doctrines were celebrated on these solemn occasions. that these dramas were carefully staged and magnificently performed, we cannot doubt. For the Greek stage already had developed most of the machinery of the modern theater, and we have no reason to suppose that if the Greeks were able to present the magnificent dramas of Aeschylus and Sophocles, that they would have been deficient in anything necessary to stagecraft. We also know that the themes of these rituals were sacred legends, sacred stories, particularly in the great rites of Eleusis, the story of the abduction of Persephone by Hades, king of the underworld. Now we can well imagine that thoughtful and scholarly and cultured Grecian would appreciate such spectacles. But we also know that they had a splendid profane stage, and that when we say profane in relation to their stage, we do not mean corrupt. We mean a stage of non-religious nature, where drama was performed, where vast audiences gathered and applauded roundly for their favorite thespians. Therefore, we cannot assume that the Greeks had to attend the mysteries in order to see good theater. They had it constantly in their communities. Furthermore, what we would term profane theater today was really almost a sacred theater in the time of the Greeks. Most of the successful plays that were presented involved divine and mythological factors. And today we would regard many of the common theatrical productions of the Greeks as little less than initiatory rituals. Therefore, it was not necessary for the Greeks to attend the sacred ceremonies of the mysteries in order to see mythology come to life upon their stage. There is very little that we can imagine in the religious theater of the Greeks that was not available to the general public. This means that the substance and essence of the divine rites could not have been merely theatrical presentations of familiar and well-known stories and legends. The legend of Persephone was known to nearly all the Greeks, and in the various schools that rose in Greek philosophy, such as the Platonic and the Pythagorean, the legends of these deities were interpreted philosophically and mystically, and such interpretations were not held as necessary secrets. Thus, we cannot come to the conclusion that the real substance behind the dramas of the mysteries was merely a theatrical representation of some religious theme. Now, the second element that we know did exist in these rituals were the exhibitions of sacred objects. Just as in the ancient Jewish religion, certain articles of great sanctity were reserved in the Ark of the Covenant and were only to be seen on certain most important festival occasions. So the Greeks had certain esoteric emblems, symbols of their origin, symbols of their faith, symbols of their great earlier religious and philosophic teachers, that very well might have been specially exhibited at such a time. Also, the Greek mysteries arose from agrarian or agricultural cults of a greater antiquity. And it is reported that the Hierophant of the Mysteries at Eleusis at one time did exhibit to the assembled throng in the temple the growing shoot of wheat as an emblem of some deep spiritual significance. therefore, that certain objects not generally available to the people, perhaps only to be seen under such conditions, relics, perhaps even objects of talismanic or magical impute, might also be shown at these occasions. But here again, we do not have any solid ground for the profound veneration in which these rituals were held. Some of the early writers were of the opinion that it was in the mystery rituals that the Greek thinker came face to face with the Asiatic doctrine of immortality. Here we have something that perhaps we should ponder a little further. We know that the early Greeks had practically no clear insight as to the mystery of an afterlife. Perhaps we can liken them to most other nations of a similar antiquity. For in China, there was the belief that the deceased person went to sleep in his grave, and the objects that he might like or need were buried with him for his comfort in the afterlife. It was assumed that he was going to live on in his tomb in some kind of a strange magical manner. There was no concept in the ancient Chinese that this man would be rewarded or punished for his conduct in this world. He simply became a ghost or a shadow. This likewise was the attitude among the Greeks at the time of Homer, and it was not until the rise of the Orphic cult that we began to find some traces of the integration of a concept of the afterlife. It was also probably after Greek contact with Asia that the doctrine of immortality came to be more clearly defined, and this doctrine probably reached Greece from Asia through Egypt, where it began to affect the rituals of the Egyptian rites. Thus, we may say it is conceivable that some deep and important understanding of the mystery of life after death might have been communicated in the mysteries. Here again, however, there seems to be no justification for the peculiar secrecy in regard to these doctrines. We know that the doctrine of immortality was clearly enunciated by Socrates and also by Plato. We know that it was held by the schools of Greeks back at least to the time of Solon and Thales. Yet with the rise of the popular acceptance of the doctrine of immortality, there was no diminution of interest in the mysteries. Consequently, we cannot assume that the public instruction of the people on the matter of immortality could have in any way interfered with the peculiar mystery of the sacred rituals. Thus, it must have been something deeper and more important than this. The next possibility that has loomed is that the entire ritual was a highly psychological thing. That actually, as some of the early converted Christians have admitted, that the soul and substance of the great ritual was a form of Eucharistic ceremony upon which perhaps the high mass of Christianity was established. Here was a great religious Eucharistic mystery. A mystery presented largely through ritual, but containing, as in the case of the Christian Eucharist, the assumed presence of a miraculous factor. Namely, that in the ritual of Eleusis, there had begun to arise the belief that certain rites and rituals performed in certain ways at certain times by certain persons had a virtue, power, or spiritual authority not possible under any other condition, and thereby justifying the assembly of the people and the various tests and trials which led to acceptance into the Eleusinian mysteries. Here again, however, we are on rather thin ground. For assuming that a Eucharistic mystery might have been implied, and there is evidence that something of this nature actually did occur, there is still no clear reason why the long and difficult course of preparation for initiation should be prescribed in connection with such a ceremony. The student of the Greek mysteries, who was hoping that sometime he might become an initiate, passed through certain trials, tests, examinations, and preparations, which would not apparently be essentially associated with any form of ceremonialism. For example, a promising young man who hoped to become accepted into the mysteries was first of all examined by his tutor, or by whoever was his ordinary and common instructor. That is the equivalent of the modern schoolmaster in the community where he dwelt. He was tested in all the common forms of knowledge. The test seemed to suggest an entry examination into a scholastic institution. After he had been carefully examined in mathematics, astronomy, music, poetry, art, literature, and drama, and whatever other arts or sciences were regarded as necessary, he was then turned over to the chief magistrate of the city or town, where a thorough investigation of his background, his family, and everything relating to his character was undertaken. If there was any blemish or doubt concerning his moral or his ethical standard of life, he would be immediately rejected. So, having been examined in all arts and sciences and endorsed as to character in all regards, he was then submitted to the priestly members of the priestly college, these being the essential guardians of the rituals. Here, certain further instruction and interrogation took place. He was given various problems to solve involving various degrees of thoughtfulness. His physical health and stamina were tested. He was forced to compete in physical games or athletics to indicate fitness of body. He was subjected to many trials of the flesh, of fasting, of extreme hardship, of the inclemency of weather. He was given every kind of an examination that might suggest ways of probing into the self-mastery which he possessed in the various ordinary affairs of life. Only after he had been tested in all these matters was he then further instructed and prepared for the actual initiatory rites. These preliminary tests apparently were carried on in many different systems of the mysteries in the Mediterranean area, and were even finally brought to Rome, where initiation preparation included mortal combat of armed men. Thus, it is hard to assume that this would all be necessary in order that the individual might be the enlightened or unenlightened spectator to a solemn religious ceremony. There is no indication in the Greek rites that the candidates actually participated in the ceremony. In the Licinia, for example, at the bestowing of the lesser ritual, perhaps 25,000 persons were initiated at one time. Now, in this case, the initiation ritual, which was called the Lesser Rite, probably derived from the old idea of the bestowal of citizenship. The individual who was initiated into the state mysteries became a particularly respectable citizen. It was assumed that this was a proof of integrity, of honor, and ability. It was a kind of dignification which the person would carry throughout life, which might correspond to some and bestowal of knighthood in the ages of chivalry, or some special token of exceptional character, which might be useful and even profitable to the individual in the years of life that followed. He was naturally then regarded as a person of consequence, worthy to be a citizen. This is interesting, however, because in the lesser rituals of the Eleusinia, small children were initiated. And there are records of children being initiated as early as their second and third years. Thus, we must wonder a little as to what the esoteric content of such a ritual might imply. In this ritual also, there was no distinction between men and women. Persons of both sexes were equally initiated, and initiation consisted apparently of beholding the spectacle, or in some way being present when a great drama was bestowed. Obviously, however, this dramatic part, especially in relation to the lesser mysteries, was really only a fulfillment of the previous requirements, namely that the individual was present and permitted to partake of this ritual only because he had already been established on the level of his education and the level of his character by the proper endorsing officers. Thus, this was simply a symbol of his right to be there. How and why small children attained this right is still one of the unsolved problems of the Eleusinian ritual. We also know, of course, that the greater rites, which were not performed as often, were more exclusive and were bestowed only upon those who had attained some measure of unusual ability. The greater rites were then given not to individuals, but to much smaller groups. These very small groups being persons who had more or less graduated from the courses of instruction which had been provided to them after they had taken the lesser ritual. Thus it would be obvious that small children would not be able to take the greater ritual. We must assume, therefore, that the primary ritual had something to do with the establishment of the right of the citizen, that it had something to do with the acceptance into the clan, and probably came from a very early cultus in which even small children had to become members of their tribe by means of special rites and ceremonies. Now, if the lesser mysteries, for instance, did culminate in some kind of a divine pageantry, intimating or suggesting a Eucharistic rite, we could see where and how such rituals would gain great authority and interest among the people. But even so, we are still confronted with the absence of a real content, a content that would be entirely suitable to meet the legends and the lore and the tradition about the peculiar and outstanding merit or value of this ritualistic procedure. We gain one slight insight into this from another phase of our problem, namely the idea that these rituals were attended by some form of profound emotional exhilaration, that some strange ecstasy possessed those who participated in these rites. And we may therefore suspect that somewhere concealed in this ritualism was something which perhaps resembled that process of the dervishes or these other people to whom religious insight led finally to an ecstasy or some strange sense of mystical union with the gods. If we come into this phase of the problem, we begin to see how we might have a much larger and more solid foundation for secrecy. The next point involved in the secrecy concept relates to the communication of certain words, certain names, which may be regarded as representing the password or the various means by which initiated members of these rites could communicate this fact to others, that by means of certain words or certain symbols which they possessed or which were conferred upon them by the initiation, they had a common way of knowing others of their own kind, and also perhaps a means of gaining admission into other mysteries and rituals of other nations if they traveled in distant countries. It is apparent that such occurred in the case of both Pythagoras and Plato. For by some means, generally assumed to have been their initiation, they were welcomed into the temple sanctuaries of many far and distant peoples. Thus some broad secret society, conferring certain privileges not essentially religious, but privileges perhaps implying reception in other religious organizations of similar nature, by which the initiate became, in a sense, a citizen of an empire of initiates. And by means of his words and signs and symbols, was able to identify himself as such whenever need arose. Sometime, probably about 600 years before the beginning of the Christian era, there is evidence that the Greek mysteries underwent a considerable change. We know that prior to that time, the rites of initiation and the rites of priesthood and the rites of guardianship over the secrets of the mysteries, these descended in certain Greek families, in the same way that the religious privileges and the medical privileges generally descended. Thus, the mysteries were family possessions. They belonged within the structure of certain families. And while they were bestowed upon non-members of these families, the right to bestow them was held as a kind of legacy, as an inheritance from one generation to another. By the 6th or 7th century B.C., however, this system seems to have broken down, and the mysteries became state institutions, governed by the whole people and administered by the various governments which regulated the policies and laws of the Greek state. Thus we have a change in structure, and we find this change also in the doctrinal setup. The older doctrine is very obscure, but by the time of Pythagoras, Plato, and Socrates, the new doctrine of the mysteries was certainly taking shape within the structure of both the Orphic rites and the Eleusinia. This new breath, this new kind of air upon the subject, very likely came from Asia. If this occurred, then we begin to see how the mysteries could have gradually kept up with the developing and unfolding of the national life. it is quite conceivable that at very ancient times, the most simple and common sacrifice might be held to be profoundly secret. But with the rise of a philosophic nation, this would no longer be possible. But if the old rituals were again reinterpreted in terms of some higher structure of philosophy, then perhaps we would have justification in assuming that they were able to maintain their leadership over the minds of the people. Several writers working on this problem have come to several conclusions. First of all, there is the very formal school, which has not failed, however, to work rather hard with this subject, that excludes the possibility of any true transcendentalism. This matter-of-fact school insists that the existence of the mysteries as secret societies long venerated were sufficient to permit their perpetuation without any real or clear meaning, and that membership or initiation was such an honor in itself that this sufficed and was the only reward that was needed. This, however, I think is rather a modern way of looking at this type of thing, and probably not the way that Socrates or Plato would have chosen to look at it. The second attitude was that the followers of these rites, because they were in the presence of the traditional religious system of their people, presumably bestowed in the beginning by the gods themselves upon the progenitors of their nation, that these rites and ceremonies were held in such great sacredness, and the various legends and myths were held to have such strange and profound meaning, that the scholars and philosophers were perfectly willing to accept the rituals as Kabbalahs, as possessing within them many kinds of meanings, and that students in every walk of life would endow these rituals with their own understanding, and in that way would attend and be initiated on the ground that they would be in the presence of a great knowledge if they could interpret it, if they could discover it. For in some way, these rituals perpetuated the original instruction given by the gods at the beginning of time in the establishment of their cultures. This type of thinking could envelop the whole thing with a very mystical atmosphere and yet be comparatively devoid of any actual metaphysical substance. It could all be interpretational. It could all be glamour. It could all be religious enthusiasm. There is a parallel for such an attitude in many faiths of the modern world, where although these faiths are deeply regarded and deeply respected and strongly supported, there is really nothing that really suggests a profound mystery, except that the believer, believing that these things are sacred, derives from his own believing a certain assurance, a certain security, support, and strength in time of trouble. This could be the answer to the Greeks, and could be the answer even to the perplexed mind of Plato, who might regard himself as by far too involved a thinker to experience the direct participation in a simple faith which brought great benefits to the devout believer. The third group of interpreters are forced to assume that there was something, something beside and beyond all that we have suggested, and that this something had to be really important. To be really important, it had to involve some kind of knowledge or experience that could not be otherwise attained. Assuming that all knowledge can be communicated, it becomes obvious that in the course of over 15 centuries in which these mysteries flourished, that some could have attempted to expose them, and probably did, Yet these exposés came to nothing. Even Socrates was accused of exposing the mystery. And Aristophanes, in his play The Frog, was accused also of taking something from the sacred ritual. Actually, however, anything that could be taken in this way and adapted to a play or embodied in a dialogue could not have been the true substance of these rites. And the Greeks themselves, undoubtedly, by the time of Plato and Socrates, had a fair knowledge of any common subject that might have been considered within these mystery rituals. In fact, a large part of Greek philosophy seems to have been built upon interpretation of these legends and fables, perhaps in the light of the Eleusinian formula. But these interpretations did not, again, lead to the decline of the mysteries. They had something else, apart and separate from all these elements which we have discussed. We also know that in Egypt and in India, China, and on the mainland of the Near East, there already existed institutions dedicated to the advancement of knowledge by truly mystical, metaphysical, or esoteric means. And while the students of the Greek theory will regard the word esoteric as little better than a bad word, the fact remains that there is no reason to doubt that the Greeks could have been part of this complex of schools of thought that were directly working upon problems that we might call today problems of yoga or Vedanta or Zen or something of that nature. We come gradually to the conviction that whether these things were taught to the multitudes or not, the hard core underneath the Greek mystery must have been something essentially valid and valuable. We also have every reason to note that the Neoplatonists, who attempted the restoration of these mysteries, did so on an entirely mystical level, that their philosophy dealt primarily with theurgy, which was the transmutation or transformation of knowledge into an energy for the vitalizing of the consciousness of the soul. Thus, if we can assume that underneath the Greek ritual there was this same element that has always been beneath the surface of religion since the dawn of time, then the Greeks would be perfectly understandable and explainable in the light of the common world attitude. We know that such mysteries were practiced among the Jewish people. We know that the Sod, or the Assembly of the Enlightened, was a very important body within Jewish metaphysics. We know that the pre-Islamic cults of the Near East had their esoteric doctrines. So did the Chaldeans and Babylonians in the Valley of the Euphrates. We know there was magic and mystery in the rites of Egypt, and of course in all of the great systems of Asiatic culture. Assuming then, as Pythagoras has given us sufficient insight to permit us to assume, that the Eleusinian mysteries were not a unique attitude, but were really only part of a distribution representing a culture level, then Pythagoras would have been correct when he said that having visited India and been initiated into the mysteries of the Brahmins at Elephanta and Ellora, and having in all passed through 21 different religious institutions by initiation, returned and said that they all taught the same thing, and that this same thing that they taught was the same that the Greek mysteries taught. If they all taught the same thing, it is almost inevitable that we are dealing with some form of basic metaphysical equation. Otherwise, certainly, Pythagoras could not have included early Brahmanism with its mass of metaphysical speculation as being the same as the initiation rituals of the Greeks. If, therefore, we are dealing now with what seems we must deal with, the presence of an esoteric factor, we get into a very deep and mysterious and complicated region. We know, for instance, that among the Greeks came into existence most of the arts and sciences of Western culture. We know that the Greeks were master mathematicians. We know that they established the foundations of music and astronomy. We know that they were leaders of the world in rhetoric, in logic, and in many other branches of learning. These forms of learning all apparently originated in the temple. All of the greater initiates were men of unusual scholarship, and nearly all of the great scholars of the Greeks were initiates. This seems to suggest that in some way the arts and sciences of the Greeks must have arisen from certain speculations held within the temple, or practiced or revealed through the temple ceremonies. And there is also much to suggest that in these ceremonies, anything that was known in arts and sciences would have been used as adroitly and skillfully as possible to advance the general purpose of initiation. At the Epidaurium, where the cult of the god of healing, Asclepius, was practiced, the sick were brought in to a great domed room, in the midst of which was a magnificent statue of the god of healing. They were placed upon couches around the base of the figure, and each was given some kind of a narcotic drug that produced dreams and visions. In the night, these people believed that they saw the god, that he stepped down from the pedestal, walked among them, and diagnosed their various ailments, whispering into the ear of each the proper remedy. In the morning, the priest went around and inquired from each of the sick what experiences had come to him in sleep, carefully recorded these experiences, and treated the sick person according to the visions he had received. Now, this is a curious concept of healing. And yet, according to the ancients, it was amazingly successful. We can only assume that the Greeks had learned that somewhere in the subconsciousness of each individual is the power to diagnose his own ailment. But some way, somehow, man is able psychologically to become aware of what was wrong with him, and was able to suggest, perhaps in symbolic or veiled terms, some remedy suitable to his needs. Having suggested this remedy, and convinced that the remedy had been given to him by the god, the patient taking the remedy was immediately helped. Now, whether the Greeks were sufficient psychologists to realize that such therapy could well arise from the faith of the person, whether this is true, we do not know. But perhaps it is not even relevant, because the records of the temple are that countless persons recovered, went home rejoicing, and enjoyed good health for many years thereafter. If such is the case, the exact method of the attainment is of the detail. The fact itself is the important thing. Perhaps the Greeks were already aware of enough of psychology to be able to clarify this point. But one thing is certain. When the sufferers went to the Epidaurian temple and were thus given these narcotic drought and had these visions, they did not assume that by means of this narcotic they have been led into hallucination. They believed rather that by certain herbs their inner vision had been cleared, and that they were therefore able temporarily by artificial means to attain mystical experiences. Now it is conceivable that this type of procedure may have occurred in some of the so-called state mysteries, whereby the burning of fumigation or by a Eucharistic cup which contains some special potion, a psychic sensitivity might be created in the beholder. But in some way, either by such means or by the sheer power of suggestion, a suggestion perhaps skillfully and magnificently imparted by masters of knowledge of the human mind and its functions, the individual, the neophyte for initiation, the candidate, might have been caused to actually experience something beyond this world. There seems to be no doubt that this has to have been the essential principle behind the Greek mysteries. Something had to be done by some means whereby the individual had an experience otherwise impossible to him. This experience had to be reasonable. It had to be rational. It had to take the form of an enlightenment. It had to be in some form a mystical experience, in itself unforgettable, by means of which the total life of the initiate was altered, by which he actually came to firmly and positively believe to the degree of absolute knowledge that he had seen something, had done something, had been somewhere, had experienced something that was not normally possible to the human being, and that this thing which he experienced had to in some way strengthen or direct his faith, create in him a greater sense of honor, ennoble his character, enlighten his mind, and refresh his soul. These are the things that had to have happened, and these are the very things that the modern researcher fears might have happened, and is loath to admit that such thing was possible. Yet, if it could occur, and did occur, only a very few miles away at the Temple of Asclepius, there is no reason why it could not have occurred in the greater major ceremonial of the greater mysteries. I doubt if anything of this kind actually occurred in the lesser rites. But in the final initiation ceremony, something happened. Something had to have happened. And there are only very few things that could have happened. And when we go in another lecture in this series into the problem of Brahman initiation, I think we may get a very good clue to this, because Pythagoras is known to have visited India, and it is quite conceivable that some of the changes that later arose in the mysteries were due to the commerce of minds between the East and West. There seems to be only one thing that could have been communicated in the Eleusinia, under its symbolism, by its rites, through its ceremonies, and perhaps through an absolute theophanic incident of some nature, a true theophany, a true experience, namely that in some way the candidate in initiation experience the actual fact of life after death. This seems to have been about the only explanation we have. For it is still, in our world, a supreme mystery. Today, our way of life is built upon a hope of an afterlife. There was a hope of an afterlife in the time of Plato and Socrates. Socrates was not sure of it, but rather optimistic. Plato was convinced of it. Pythagoras knew it as early as the 5th and 6th centuries B.C., but he was in India. We know that Apollonius of Tyana later visited India. We have every reason to assume the possibility that it was from this type of contact that he brought back some of the information and some of the teaching that was to affect Neoplatonism, Neopythagoreanism, and Gnosticism. But if in the Greek ritual, the myth of the dying god, the myth representing the death and resurrection of Attis, for whom, as for Adonis, the women wept at the gates of Jerusalem, if the mystery of the death and resurrection of the god was in some way closely associated with the mystery of the death and resurrection of human consciousness, then we have the element of a great Eucharistic mystery. We have the elements of a great resurrection rite, which we know these things were, but we know that they were rites of great rejoicing. They were not rites of fear or of intimidation. Those who came forth out of the mysteries came forth, their faces radiant as with the light of a thousand suns, says one of the old rituals. These persons have been lifted up in some extraordinary way. Yet whatever this way was, it could not be an experience limited to one person only. It had to be something by means of which a group of persons could be simultaneously picked up in a mystery. Now, there are many ways in which such things can be done. There are many ways in which an individual can be moved from the matter-of-factness of his daily living to an experience in which he loses all definition or boundary of the possible or the impossible. And it is quite possible also that these older peoples were much more skilled in these things than we have become. But we do remember that in the early centuries of Christianity, the very church fathers who insisted, like Clement of Alexandria, that what the Christian claimed was no more than the pagan claimed, but was using different words. This is, we have every reason to suspect from their own words, the communion cup was drugged with narcotics in the early church. It is quite possible that this was an effort to reenact or to compete successfully with the rituals of the mystery. There is every suspicion of this. The Oracle of Trophonius in Greece was an oracle that was served by sulfurous gases in a cave. And the person seeking the advice of the oracle slept in these cubes and had these experiences during sleep. Or the Pythian oracle at Delphi was again an oracle of fumes and vapors, where the Pythian or priest entranced upon the tripodium over the fissure from which arose volcanic fumes, were thrown into a kind of drugged trance, during which she revealed the will of the gods and the words of the gods in hexameter verse. Here we have four parallel examples. We have the definite story of the Epidaurian and Asclepius. We have the record of the Trophonian oracle, the record of the Delphian oracle, and the record of the early use of drugs in the Christian communion. Here we have various methods used to create some type of extrasensory experience. We know that the Druids of Britain were very skilled in anesthesia. We know that the Greeks and Romans used anesthesia, and that it was later forgotten and to a large measure rejected by early Christendom. was that these people actually performed surgery under anesthesia, and that therefore they did know the operating of narcotic drugs. In any event, let us say there are many ways in which a trance, an hypnotic state, a mesmeric state could be induced. The dactyls of Samothrace were able to apparently to create various magical results by means of magnetized wands and the use of lodestone. The legends of antiquity abound with mystery. But whatever occurred at the Greek rituals would undoubtedly have been of the highest and most advanced type known at that time, perhaps far in advance of anything that we have been able to recover in the forms of lost knowledge even today. Supposing from the rituals and mysteries of Pythagoras, the Greeks had learned how to control human consciousness by music alone, this is quite possible. We are beginning to sense the possibility of it. But supposing by the knowledge of music, they were actually able to create trances, that they were actually able to variously affect the internal consciousness of the human being. Or, let us say for a moment, another Pythagorean experiment, later revised and worked on, color therapy. The idea that by color and by the use of lights, reflectors and similar things, the consciousness of the individual could be reached therapeutically and psychically. Also, let us remember that primitive people from all over the world have united in discovering the tremendous psychic power of rhythm. How through their simple jungle drums and things of that nature, these primitive peoples have been able to throw themselves into an ecstasy which carried them out of this world into a strange trance-like existence. The dervishes also used the dance for this purpose, attempting to unite their own motion to cosmic motion. Supposing our Greeks also knew the power of sound, knew the mysterious vibratory rates of sound, and combining all these and perhaps other things that we do not know and have never been able to restore, we're able to involve this psychological machinery into the rituals of initiation. We can very easily sense how it would not be very hard to move a person already receptive, already expectant, already waiting breathlessly for the very presence of the gods, to be moved from a state of being a spectator to a drama, rather to the condition of being a participant in a mystery. These things have happened in private case many, many times, and we have no reason to doubt that under the skillful knowledge of highly informed persons, almost any mood or state that was desired could be conjured into existence. The modal music of the Greeks is a good example of this, and the laws and restrictions in which these modes were administered, because it was definitely affirmed by the Greeks that by modal music any condition of the soul desired could be stimulated, or the soul could be blocked in this mood. And also it was held that by music any building in Greece could be destroyed simply by vibration. Perhaps here we have the secret of the blowings of the trumpets around the walls of Jericho. Here let us say for a moment that we want to approach this thing rather psychologically. Let us remember the Peyote cult. Let us remember the problems that we are now attempting to research in the psychic and clairvoyant and mystical and psychical power of mushrooms. Let us consider all these things and say to ourselves, is it possible that in some way, by some means, probably a very lawful means, a means certainly that could bring no injury or detriment to the individual,